Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mike Slifirski. I'm an analyst with Credit Suisse based in Melbourne in Australia. I've had the pleasure of covering Newcrest for my entire period of 22 years, and the 5 years prior to that as a mining engineer consulting to Newcrest at Cadia in the very early days, pre-development, and at Telfer. So a long-term association. And I guess over those 27 years of pretty close scrutiny of the company, I can make a few comments, and things like never afraid to undertake complex projects that others wouldn't contemplate undertaking, not afraid of pushing technology boundaries, and really I guess that comes together to give you a company that's got some pretty unique skills to undertake complex projects that others simply can't look at and to deliver incredible success and longevity. So please welcome Gerard. It's a pleasure to have Gerard back here again. I guess over my years of coverage, I've seen complete turnover of the executive team, complete turnover of the board, and almost complete turnover of the assets to an asset suite that's now better than ever. So, Gerard, welcome back to the ARC. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike, for those very kind words. I hope I don't let you down with some interesting technology that we've applied to our presentation today. I'm actually going to talk about why Newcrest is different and what makes it so. Before I do, I'd just like to congratulate Credit Suisse on what is actually a fabulous conference. Every day I wake up and I look at the agenda and almost hope that I didn't have to meet shareholders, which is what occupies my day, and actually spend more time out at many of these great presentations, which look fantastic. So it's a simply great conference. But rest assured, I think you're all in the right presentation right now. I'll just draw your attention to our disclaimer, which relates to forward-looking statements, the competent person statement, and the use of non-IFRS financial information in this presentation. The theme of this presentation is what makes Newcrest different. And like all companies, we aspire to create long-term shareholder value. And we believe what makes us different is listed on this page. Six things. One, our unique reserve life position. We have three assets that have the potential for a life of 30 years or more. And as I'll show you shortly, that's quite distinctive in the gold industry. We have a low cost position. At $770 all-in sustaining costs per ounce for the last half year, they are that's industry-leading, as I'll also show you. We do what we say. For more than 3 years now, we have met or exceeded group production guidance. We have also met a number of other very important objectives as it relates to, say, increasing the milling rate at Lihir. We have organic growth options, which in our industry is the best form of growth option. It means that it's in your control, you know it, you don't have to pay for it. We have a unique set of technical skills that Mike just referred to, and I'll elaborate on that a little bit more in the presentation. And we have a world-leading exploration team. That gives us the confidence of being able to find other Tier 1 assets and also to convert what would otherwise be undesirable assets into Tier 1 or Tier 2 assets. And finally, we're focused on remaining financially robust. We have got ourselves into a position of having a very strong balance sheet, and that position is a great base for which to launch a further pursuit of shareholder value creation. So the first of those six unique features about Newcrest as a company is our reserve life. And as this graph shows, you know, we are relative to the six other largest gold producers in the gold industry. Uniquely positioned. The x-axis, I don't think I have a Q here, do I? There we go. The x-axis along here is reserve life as measured by your total reserves divided by your last 12 months of production. And the y-axis is your margin per ounce produced. And we create that margin per ounce using a $1,200 gold price less your all-in sustaining cost and interest expense per ounce. And on this slide, in this depiction, where you want to be is at the top right corner. You want to have long life and you want to be low cost or make the most margin per ounce. And that's where Newcrest is. So a great spot to be and very, very distinctive in the industry. In the gold industry, as I'm sure in other extractive industries, some commentators make the observation that not everybody's reserves that are booked as reserves are productive. By that, I mean they're not in production or they relate to assets that are dormant, not yet developed or have a distant and or uncertain future development time frame. So what this next slide looks to do is to adjust those reported reserves and implied life to exclude those assets that are dormant, not yet in development or have distant future production, or shortly about to exit the portfolio of the relevant company. And what you can see, if I just toggle back and forth, is that, as expected, everybody moves to the left, but Newcrest remains distinctly long life, and other companies move a long way further to the left. Newcrest sits in this metric at 23 years, I should say, of life, and all of our gold industry peers, bar one, sit well inside 15 years or less. And that's important in our industry because typically it takes, we estimate, around 15 years at best to move from discovery of a Tier 1 ore body to its development and production. And having 23 years of reserve life on our productive assets basis gives us the time, which matches with our capability, to explore, to find, to develop cheaply new production sources. This slide evidences where we sit on the all-in sustaining cost curve relative to our gold industry peers, the majors. And again, all those companies in aggregate are the companies that are the seven largest producers of gold globally. The blue depicts our all-in sustaining cost per ounce. The orange overlay is the interest expense per ounce. And again, the Newcrest sits there comfortably around $800 an ounce, which, you know, in the current gold price, lower or higher, represents great margins. We're not focused on the amount of ounces we produce per se, but rather the amount of cash we make per ounce produced. And as this graph shows, relative to others in our industry, we achieve pole position in that regard. I think it's also worth noting that about 3 years ago, that Newcrest's all-in sustaining costs sat at around $1,200 per ounce, which is not where you want to be. And that journey to where we've been from there to where we are today has been one which is basically focused on cash, focused on operating discipline, running our assets better, and I'll talk a little bit more about that going forward. This is a graph that we like to show, most commonly because our North American shareholders like to point it out to us, that relative to other gold companies in the industry, and this is a broader suite of gold industry choices, Newcrest trades at a discount to the average when valued on an enterprise value to reserve ounce basis. And there are many reasons for this. But one of the main reasons is that the discounted cash flow valuations, which is, you know, unquestionably the right way to value any extractive industry company, has the effect of, regardless of what discount rate you use, has the effect of, in essence, penalising Newcrest for those long and distant reserves. Anything, no matter what discount rate you're using, after about 15 years, not much value is placed on it. So what you're really finding is that you're getting about 15 years of production valued, and then the longer reserve life pretty much represents a low-cost source of future value for our shareholders. Our job as management is to actually accelerate the realisation of that reserve value and bring that value to the shareholder sooner. And we're looking to do that across all of our operations, but most significantly and impactfully at Cadia by increasing the rate at which we mill the ore there, and likewise at Lihir. We've had a history of setting ambitious targets for increasing the milling rate, and I'll talk about that a little bit further. And hopefully our hope is over time, by achieving those accelerations of milled volume, we will allow more value to be put on Newcrest on a per share basis. Lihir is a great example for me just to dwell on. Lihir is a one of the world's largest ore bodies. It had a very poor history of meeting its targets, and for the best part of the last 3 years, it has now had a history of meeting or exceeding its targets. And we measure that principally for very good reasons by reference to the milling rate, because all other things being equal, if we mill more ore, we will make more gold. And if we make more gold, we'll make more cash for our shareholders. We had a history, if you look at the slide on the left-hand side there, about 2.5 years ago, we had pretty much plateaued around 10 million tonnes per annum milling rate. And in around November 2014, we set a target of lifting that by 20%, which is quite a significant lift in milling rate by 12 months hence, December 2015. And I'm pleased to say that that target was achieved. Shortly before achieving that target, we set a new milling rate of 13 million tonnes by December 16. And pleasingly, as you can see there, we also achieved that. And we've most recently set a target to achieve 14 million tonnes by December 2017. And that's significant because, again, as I said, all other things being equal, grade, recovery and the like, if we mill more through the mill, that we believe that to be the bottleneck, the production constraint on the site, we will make more gold. And as shown on the graph on the right-hand side, you can see a near-perfect correlation between the amount of production you achieve and then your all-in sustaining cost. In other words, produce more gold, your all-in sustaining cost falls because it's a fairly high fixed cost base, and you have the double effect of both increasing the amount of production and lowering the margin, which combines to allow you to produce more cash. And Lihir, in the last 18 months, has produced $430 million of free cash flow, which is fabulous. I'd now like to take you through a video, which is one exhibition of the technology adoption that Newcrest is applying to the world, and here's hoping it works. So what I'm going to do is talk you through this video. Lihir is located in Papua New Guinea. It's on an island about 900 kilometres away from Port Moresby. The island has a population of around 17,000 people. We acquired Lihir Gold in 2010. It's one, as I said before, it's one of the world's largest ore bodies. It's got a reserve base of 26 million ounces. It's got 56 million ounces of resources. There's the mine. The mine actually is in a caldera or an extinct volcano, and it's quite an impressive site there. The mining method is a conventional one. It's an open pit mine. We drill and blast, as you see. The crushed rock is loaded onto our trucks. The trucks then haul that crushed rock up to the crushers, and you'll shortly see the truck disgorge its rock into that crusher. The crusher then transports that crushed rock along a 2.2 kilometre conveyor belt to the coarse ore stockpile, which you see there. And from that point, the material can be streamed to any one of three different grinding circuits, each with a SAG mill and each with a ball mill. You see there the SAG and ball mills in operation. From that point, a part of the material will go to a flotation circuit where the material or the gold grade thereof is upgraded. That's one of the float cells there. After leaving that float circuit, it will join the rest of the other direct feed material in our pre-oxidation tanks. Aerial shot there. The next aerial shot will show the broader infrastructure there, including the diesel power station, the oxygen plant. We also produce geothermal energy on site as well. Material from the pre-ox tanks goes into our autoclaves, and that there's an autoclave there, or a schematic of it, and that's necessary because the gold at Lihir is refractory in nature, which basically means we need to apply pressure and heat to separate the gold from the ore. The oxidation process makes the particles more porous so the gold can be extracted further down the circuit. We take it through what's called a CCD circuit, which washes the material to remove the sulfuric acid. It then goes into what's called an NCA, or neutralisation carbon adsorption circuit, which leaches it from a solid to a solution form. Then we add what is there, activated carbon. The activated carbon absorbs the gold like a sponge from the solution, and that material is then put through a strip circuit, which again, under temperature and pressure, the gold comes off the carbon back into a high-grade solution form. Electrowinning occurs in the gold room, and it is poured and finally comes into the form of a gold doré bar, as held by one of our colleagues there. And that's our product at Lihir, gold doré. Our success at Lihir is inextricably linked to our relationships with the local community, and I can confidently say that the relationships that we have with the local community at Lihir have never been better. We've been in the community more. That's our Executive General Manager, Craig Jetson. We get the community engaged in the mine plan. We get them trained to maximise their chance of employment at the mine. And we've delivered a number of on-the-ground projects that is making their life better. But in summary, Lihir has a reserve life of close to 30 years, or a resource life if that was converted into reserves beyond that. It's been quite a turnaround journey in its performance, and we're not done yet. But again, pleasingly to say, $430 million of free cash flow derived from the site in the last 18 months to December 2016 is a step change in the perception of the performance and the potential at Lihir. Back to the six things that make Newcrest different. One of them I said was our strong organic growth pipeline, and what this slide lists is our combination of near-term, medium-term and longer-term options. And it's great having organic growth, as I said before, because it means we're not under pressure to acquire production, which typically in our industry works really well for the acquiree and sometimes less well for the acquirer. We're going to focus on progressing all of these options as best we can simultaneously. In the near term, we have a number, as listed there, of really low capital, fast payback focus areas that will, again, as I said before, accelerate the realisation of those reserve ounces at our two leading current producing sites. In the medium term, we have the opportunity to expand the plant at Cadia and achieve mill throughput rates beyond that which we've actually set as specific targets for Lihir. And in the longer term, we have our exploration and technology teams looking at a number of means by which they can unlock value from our asset base, and also a number of other project opportunities that we've entered into by way of early stage projects with junior companies and other resource industry companies, variously by means of joint venture, farm in and or option agreements. As Mike said at the outset, I think it's a fact that Newcrest has a fairly unique set of capabilities in the gold industry. Like everyone in the gold industry, on the top left there, we do open pit mining. In addition, we have a deep understanding of selective underground mining, be that at reef mining derived from our experience at Telfer or narrow vein mining at Gosowong. However, it's in bulk underground mining that is truly sets us apart. We started our journey with sub-level caving at Telfer and then refined it further at Cadia. It was our development of Ridgeway Deeps, our first block cave, which has given us a major competitive advantage in the gold industry. And the reason why is that all bodies that were previously considered uneconomic, such as Cadia East, have now become Tier 1 assets through this process of block caving. And we are the only gold company major of those seven companies listed on that opening slide that does this. We believe that when we combine our range of mining capabilities with our range of processing capabilities, we've got this unique position of being able to look for, identify and develop ore bodies which others might find undesirable. And the best illustration of the value that you can add through technical innovation is Cadia East, and that's what this slide looks to have me talk you through. Cadia, the province, started as an open pit. Open pit miners had delivered 4 million ounces of gold in the time that Newcrest mined it. Open pit mining became very, like all open pit mines, eventually got very expensive as it got deeper. So we started Ridgeway, the first underground mine adjacent to the Cadia open pit, using the more common technique of sub-level caving. It had a mining cost of around $11 Australian per tonne. But even as you went deeper, that got more and more expensive and it became less economic. So basically we moved firstly to a deep, our first block cave at Ridgeway. And you know, a quick step back on our journey into block caving. How did that happen? It was back in the early 2000s, late 90s. We joined an international study group comprising a number of companies, including Codelco and Rio Tinto. And basically we worked together over a number of years, trialing different caving techniques and processes for monitoring ore flow deep underground. We shared that information between the companies, and that basically allowed us to all learn from each other. And by 2005, we became confident that we could actually mine deep ore bodies, provided they were in strong ground. And that was the basis, all the technical learnings from that study and Ridgeway, the Ridgeway experience, was the basis for us making the $2 billion plus investment in Cadia East. And, you know, again, to highlight that, you know, back in the early 2000s, this is the Cadia East reserve. It had zero next to it in our reserves ledger. And today it's 23 million ounces. Not only is it the lowest cost operation in our group, it's one of the lowest cost operations or gold mines in the world with a long life. So a picture, like I hopefully you saw earlier here, can tell 1,000 words, and we're just now going to turn to our video of Cadia. So Cadia is located in Australia, west of Sydney, just south of a town, the town of Orange. It is a rich province. There's been mining in Cadia for more than 100 years. Newcrest, in its time, has mined over 9 million ounces of gold and 1 million tonnes of copper. And at this point in time, Cadia is the largest underground mining operation in Australia. We produce gold doré and a copper gold concentrate. The distinctive feature, of course, is a block cave. We access the ore body by going down a decline and to get to the very bottom of the ore body. We're operating here about 1.2 to 1.5 kilometres under surface, and that's a schematic of the Cadia East ore body. Very shortly, you'll see the declines depicted. They go down to the very bottom of the ore body. At the bottom, we develop two levels, an extraction level and an undercut level. We blast ore, and through that ore falls through a series of drawbells to draw points on the extraction level, as shown. That ore, as it's blasted, and you've got another blast coming here, is then removed by boggers. So that ore is removed by boggers, and as the bogger removes the ore, more ore drops down into the extraction level. Ultimately, as you keep bogging and more ore drops into the extraction level, the cave extends upwards to the surface. And that panel cave 1 has actually propagated all the way to the surface presently. Panel cave 2 has not yet. At the surface, it does create a subsidence zone, currently 150 metres at Cadia. There's the subsidence zone above, at surface, above the 1.2 kilometre panel cave 1. But that subsidence zone is far smaller than what it would be if it was a conventional open pit mine. Basically, by using gravity, the block cave mining method avoids the need for the expensive drill and blast. And this mining method is one of the reasons why this operation is one of the lowest cost gold mines in the world. The boggers take that crushed ore to a crusher. That's one of the crushers there. And that crushed ore, that's one of the big crushers there, then puts the crushed material onto a conveyor belt all the way up to surface. And so that's the surface operation there at Cadia. The conveyor belt you can see there, the coarse ore stockpile, the concentrator train circuits 1 and 2, which have basically high-pressure grinder rollers, sag mills, ball mills, gravity concentrators, float circuits, concentrate thickeners and the like. And very shortly you'll see the Cadia East portal pop up there at the back. So in the process of actually extracting the gold from that crushed ore brought to surface, we have crushers and high-pressure grinding rolls. And what they do is they break down the ore a little further to make it suitable for grinding. In the grinding, occurs, we have the primary milling approach is by SAG mills. Concentrated one SAG mill, shown there, was at the time when it was built the largest SAG mill in the world at 40 feet in diameter. The secondary process occurs by means of ball mills, as shown there, and that further reduces the ore size using these steel balls into a smaller level. 25% of the gold produced from Cadia is done through a gravity circuit, and that is smelted into a gold doré bars. The rest of it goes through a float circuit, and that the objective is to produce a rich copper-gold concentrate. And you're seeing the process there. The concentrate that we produce is thickened. That's the process there, and it is then ultimately pumped to a nearby place called Blaney, where it's dewatered, and then with the water content removed, it's trained off to Port Kembla and shipped to our smelter customers around the world. In summary, Cadia is a world-class mine. It's had an FY16 all-in sustaining cost of $274 per ounce. It's producing gold. That production at volume, and it's got the potential to go for 30 years. So a truly great asset. The other distinctive capability, in addition to technology, is our exploration team. And we believe in the space of exploration, we have three distinct advantages. Firstly, as I've mentioned before, our reserve base gives us the time to explore. Because clearly, if you want to find a tier one ore body, the lowest cost means by which it will come to you is by means of your own discovery. And it takes around 15 years for the time that you discover it to bring it into production. So that long reserve base gives us the time to undertake this discovery activity. Secondly, and very distinctively, we've been developing smarter targeting for deeper deposits. What that diagram on the left-hand side shows is that for the best part of 110 years, most ore bodies have been found at or near surface, with the exception of those red bubble diagrams, which are the deep underground mines there in South Africa, which are now very mature. But most people have been searching at or near the first 200, 300 metres of surface because most people are looking to develop open pit mines. The world has actually been well explored, and our belief is that the next major discoveries at scale are likely to be deep underground. And that's complementary to our third competitive advantage, which is the ability to mine all different types of ore bodies, as I mentioned, including those bulk underground mining techniques that we've developed most successfully at Cadia. This gives us the remit to search for deeper deposits and the confidence that should we find it, we'll have the ability to economically mine it. And we're deploying this knowledge to search deep undercover globally now through our various farming agreements, exploration agreements, and joint ventures around the world. Our focus over the last 3 years on the safe maximisation of cash has resulted in a six consecutive halves of strong positive free cash flow, and we've applied that overwhelmingly to the reduction of debt. We have reduced our net debt by $1.8 billion, and you can see there the really strong impact that it's had on our gearing ratio and our leverage ratio. And over the last 12 months, we've returned to paying a dividend. We want to retain this strong balance sheet position, and in the near term, you can expect that we'll continue to accumulate cash. We have a target of holding a minimum cash balance of around $500 million, and at 31 December we had $200 million, so you can expect that we'll continue to accumulate cash, and that will be the primary means by which we continue to reduce our net debt in the near term. That strong balance sheet position, as together with the long-dated nature of our debt, we basically have $2.1 billion of US PP and 144A bonds. With the exception of $100 million, which we will repay in May this year, has a very distant maturity, no covenants. We also, from a balance sheet perspective, have no goodwill on the balance sheet. We have no unfunded defined benefit pension liabilities, and a comparatively, as I will show you shortly, a very low level of future closure costs. all of which allows me to say that we're in a robust financial position. So the journey and where we sit today relative to our three of our major goal peers is depicted on this slide. The three peers that we're using for this analogy are Barrick, Goldcorp and Newmont. They're shown in the grey. And on the first metric, which is underlying EBITDA margin, you can see that back in FY 10, 11 and 12, everybody had strong EBITDA margins off the back of what were then high gold prices. But Newcrest was at the bottom of that peer group. In 2013, margins in the industry fell as the gold price fell, and Newcrest fell further to the bottom of that that peer group. Since then, you can see our restoration of EBITDA margin, and that's been primarily, as I mentioned before, by moving from a all-in sustaining cost of $1,200 an ounce to its most recent $770 per ounce. And not only has that been the main driver of our improvement in EBITDA margin, but we also, as you can see there, moved towards the top of the peer group. The graph on the right shows gearing ratio, net debt to EBITDA, plus adding to that net debt each company's closure costs as reported in their financial statements. I mean, closure costs are an obligation of future payment like anyone's net debt. And what you can see, the journey, the blue line in both cases is Newcrest, and you can see there that as we did the built Cadia East for just in excess of $2 billion from 2010 through to 2013, and also completed the expansion that was underway at the time of its acquisition of the mill at Lihir. We spent about $3 billion in aggregate on those two projects that underpin our current position, and that was the primary basis by which we our leverage increased. But for that's a corollary of that cash flow slide I showed before. Since then, we've been very much in net debt mode, and we've reduced our net debt to a point that our gearing sits at 20.8% at 31 December. And if you add on the $254 million of closure costs that we have, gearing plus closure costs gets us to about just under 23%. But that, as you can see, sits very favourably compared with our peers, Barrick, Goldcorp and Newmont. So this is the final slide. This is the wrap slide in me saying in summary what makes Newcrest different. Firstly, we have a lot of gold, 27 years as I showed before, or 23 years if you were to adjust it for productive assets only, is notably distinctive in the gold industry. We're a low-cost producer. That combined with our interest expense per ounce, we have the lowest cost relative to that peer group. We do what we say, as measured by more than 3 years of maintaining or exceeding group production guidance and achieving other metrics such as the Lihir milling rate improvement. Organic growth in the form of the options at Lihir, Cadia and Golpu, which I haven't spoken about. Golpu is a project that we have in study at the moment. It's a large copper gold porphyry mining method planned to be very similar to that at Cadia East, very high copper and gold grades. The exploration technical capability, which I've had an attempt to share with you, why we think we have a unique set of skills there, all combined with a strong balance sheet. And taken all together, that's actually a fairly unique offering in the gold industry. So that finishes my presentation as such, and I'm happy, Mike, to take any questions that you or others may have.
Thanks, Jared. Thanks for very interesting presentations and for some pretty interesting slides. I think that that end-of-life liability one is a very interesting one, particularly in the context of quite a number of asset sales recently where that's actually been crystallised and been a significant discount on sales prices. So thank you for that that slide. I might start perhaps in terms of your technical capability, your ability to turn interesting mineralised systems into highly productive ore bodies. In that context, how do you think of Telfer, a vast endowment of copper and gold, or gold and copper, an asset that repaid its capital in the 70s within about 9 months and still continues, and it's morphed from what was initially a high-grade, low-production asset to something that's lower-grade, using the various suites of technology, but not yet block caving. Is there a block caving opportunity at Telfer?
In short, Mike, that's one of the things that we're studying right now. You're right. It's the throwaway line usually is that the best place to find gold is where gold currently is being mined. And Telfer is unique. It's got about 3.1 million ounces of reserve, but a further 6 million ounces of resource. And block caving is a study that we're doing underway. It's a very much at a concept level to see whether some of those resources could, as you say, become economic, and that would have the impact of being in a very attractive investment proposition, because all the infrastructure, the plant other associated infrastructure such as roads and ports is already available to us. So that is one of the things that we're looking at right now.
Thank you. Is there a question from the audience? Yes, please, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much. Obviously, there was a big deal this week in Chile with Barrick, Kinross and Goldcorp. And so those in the industry that have cash are trying to deploy it, obviously, to increase reserves. Given your technical edge, what sort of potential is there for those sort of partnerships, or are you loath of to do those sort of things given opportunities like Telfer?
Look, I mean, I'm not going to talk on the specifics of the deal in Chile. I don't know much about it. What we are focused on is actually applying our technical skills, particularly the ability to identify and mine deep underground ore bodies. So, not in the presentation today, but in other presentations we've made, shown where in the world we've actually stepped out and have actually entered into about 13 different agreements with juniors and other companies. In places where we historically have operated, such as Papua New Guinea, Indonesia and West Africa, but also into New Zealand, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Argentina. And so we think that anywhere where there is that our perspective, we are happy to apply our technical skills to. I think the difference is that our approach is to do it by means of early stage entry, and that is we have, as I said, about 13 of these arrangements presently where we apply what is typically a very small amount of money to seed fund an exploration program, assist with the technical interpretation of the drill results, have gates either for our exit or a step up into further funding, at the end of which typically we have earned a majority interest in that project, and in some instances a takeout right. So we believe that way we can participate in, you know, multiple, in this case up to 13, such opportunities, which is A, low cost, and B, will come to us in aggregate in lower cost and going buying proven reserve ounces. So it's very much we're open for business with anyone that has prospective ground that would like to take availability of our skills.
So another question, please. Yes, sir.
Thanks. Terrific presentation, thank you. You focused very much on the supply side, I guess. I'd be interested in two things. One is the sort of demand side. You know, there's a long history of people going back to Keynes talking about gold as a barbaric relic and, you know, irrelevant. I'd be interested in your thoughts about the demand side, and who actually do you sell the gold to? That's the first thing. The second is Lihir, of course, Papua New Guinea. Looked like a terrific story, and 1,700 indigenous people. It's great that you're working well with them, but it hasn't always been like that. I'd be interested in your thoughts about the sovereign risk type issues around that asset. And then the third thing is just generally what keeps you awake at night. You know, what, it's a terrific story, but, you know, what are the sort of risk factors, really?
Yeah, thank you. Look, I mean, I'll start with the first one, because what keeps me awake at night is the safety of our employees, our workforce generally. We've had a great period of producing more cash for our shareholders over the last 2.5 years, but a bit over a year and a half ago, we had a terrible run of fatalities. We had 4 fatalities in about an 18-month period. That's utterly unacceptable. So, you know, there are hazards in our industry. That doesn't mean it should be dangerous for anyone that works there. So we've done an enormous amount of work to make that workplace safer for our people. But on a day-to-day basis, it's hour by hour, day-to-day, week by week. So that's principally what keeps me anxious, notwithstanding I know that we've done everything possible for the to keep our people safe, and we'll continue to do so. I'm going in reverse order. Papua New Guinea, look, I think the Prime Minister of the country was here, presented 2 days ago, and I think our view on Papua New Guinea is we've been there for just shy of 10 years. We're comfortable operating there. It's a jurisdiction that is conducive to and favourably disposed towards mining. There are reasons for that. It's a resource-rich country. The development of its resources generates wealth and in the form of taxes, royalties, employment, health and other education services that typically come with the development of people's natural resources. A big part of the export earnings of the country relate to the export of gold, copper, oil and gas, and palm oil, and basically that all results in a policy setting that is conducive and supportive of mining. The Companies Act is very similar to the Corporations Act in Australia. The judiciary is independent of government, the government, as you would have heard if you had heard the Prime Minister speak, is welcoming of foreign direct investment. So for all those reasons, we're comfortable operating there. It's a three tiers of engagement we have to get right: national government, provincial government, and local community. And I think I shared with you just now some of the state of our relationships with all of those stakeholders is as good now as it has ever been, and we continue to work hard at that. Some of our comfort also comes from the fact that on our board we have people with deep experience and understanding of Papua New Guinea, and also on our executive committee and in our managerial ranks. So that's how we get the comfort there. So we are comfortable with the country. Sadly, my long answers, in fact, you gave me three, meant that I've forgotten your first one.
The barbaric relic.
Oh, the barbaric relic. Yeah, now look, I mean, as producers, we focus on producing at a low cost, right? So we can't impact the price. And no producing nation and no producing company, unlike some of the more industrial or bulks, is impacted by the supply of gold. On our website and the material that we've got and can give to you after this presentation that we've made public, we've added a couple of slides which show who's actually buying the physical gold. So two markets, you've got the screen trader gold, which all I can say is volatile, and in the physical side, who's buying the gold? I think the stats that we have in our deck, half of the gold is bought by India and China combined. 47% of gold globally is in the form of jewellery. I think 36% of it is in the form of investment, and that's either in the form of gold bars, coins, and or ETFs. I think ETFs, it fluctuates a bit. It's probably the swing factor in demand, but it's sitting around 10% from memory. Technology uses, primarily mobile phone battery liners, accounts for just under 10%. That's been consistent for a number of years now, and I don't think the iPhone's going to go out of fashion anytime soon, so I think we can safely say that that's going to be a fairly solid base. And central bank buying. I don't think a central bank globally has sold a gold bar since 2011. So in part, barbarous relic jokes aside, as an investment class in its own right, as jewellery, as a store and security of people, of countries' currencies, over the long term, and for thousands of years, people have continued to buy gold. There is also a slide in our presentation material that we've loaded onto our website that says that actually relative to other commodities that you'd be very familiar with, iron ore, oil, coal, nickel, lead, in the last 6 years, gold's actually now has had the lowest range of volatility over that period than others. So it's sat comfortably in a zone of 1150 to about 1330, and when you're producing at 770 as a producer, we just focus on continuing to make good cash margins from its production.
Thank you. Is there another question, please?
Hi there. Do you think there's more scope for the 770 to actually go further? How realistic is that?
Look, we don't guide to unit cost per se. It's there are many factors at work there: exchange rates, oil prices, copper prices. But also, what we do focus on is producing more ounces, particularly at Lihir. I think I showed there that the as we produce more gold there, the fixed cost absorption is such that there is tremendous leverage. And all other things being equal, if we can continue our journey of increasing milling rate, if recovery was to be held or improved, and if grade was to be held or improved, then there is the potential, certainly, for unit cost to fall. But there are a lot of factors at work, and we focus on impacting those that we can control.
I'm just wondering, in terms of the decline of around, you mentioned earlier about 1,200 to about 7070, how much of that was actually kind of driven by technology or innovation, and how much are you actually allocating in terms of R&D, for example? Yeah. And how much of it's actually like cost savings, cost trimmings, and you know, you're probably at the tail end of it. But yeah, thanks.
Yeah, look, in no particular order, the factors that drove that improvement were producing more gold, particularly from Cadia East. Cadia East is a distinctly low cost producer. The turnaround of Lihir, moving its cost from $1,239 per ounce down to around $800. So operational improvement, and they were both a combination of volume and productivity related improvements. It hasn't just been about cost reduction per se. Some part of it's also been about more effective capital deployment. The currency has helped in our two key jurisdictions of Australia and Papua New Guinea in that period, particularly against the US dollar. And to answer your question, yes, we do put we invest money in exploration. We have a technology team, and we do fund more in an applied way activity at our sites to help drive improvement in the unit, current and future cost performance of our sites. And the cost of that R&D is actually included in that all-in cost number that you see.
We've probably got time for one last quick question, if there's one last quick question and one last quick answer. Great, thank you.
I'm just interested in the, you're one of the global majors, but what's the sort of profile of the shareholding and the sort of takeover risk, if you like, the sort of consolidation in the industry type?
Yeah, look, in broad terms, we're listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. We also have an ADR program in the US, but it's small. Also listed on the Port Moresby Stock Exchange, but primarily we're an ASX company. 30% domestic shareholder base, around 20% would be institutional, 10% retail, 70% of the register is offshore, 40%, around 40% is North American. So, you know, we have, and I think we have our top shareholders publicly listed. As to takeover risk, look, you know, that is the that is the choice of our shareholders as to which management team they want. Our focus is basically on maximising the full potential of our assets. Performance is your best form of defence, I think, for a multitude of reasons, some of which I've covered. I think we've got the confidence of our shareholders that in a managerial sense, their assets are being well managed, but ultimately the choices of the shareholders in that future scenario.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your participation, your questions. Jared, thank you very much for your presentation. And Ryan down the front, thanks for putting it together. These gentlemen need to move upstairs to a very full schedule for the rest of the day, but Ryan's certainly around if people want to contact him for follow-up information. And I think there's probably room in some of the group presentations if you need some follow-up. So thank you very much, Jared, for a really interesting presentation.